Welcome into another edition of the Best in True Crime Radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis in for Dave Schrader, who is often filming his brand new paranormal TV show, which, again, fitting with the true crime theme of the show, if I told you, I'd have to kill you as far as what's going on the set of his new show. Some great stuff, though, from what Dave told me, I can't tell you, but some great stuff. That show coming out in the fall here on a cable channel near you, and Dave will tell us a little bit more about it here as we get closer to the fall. I so want to tell you. This is like Avengers Endgame, folks. If you saw Avengers over the weekend, again, no spoilers, but if you saw some of the stuff that that Dave was doing, you'd be quite impressed with what's going on over there, what Dave is doing on set. So we'll let him spoil his own TV show. I won't get into that. Just a quick reminder here, folks. We've got events going on, and again, paranormal events, not necessarily related to true crime, but paranormal events going on throughout the nation. If you want to check it out, darknessevents.com. And we've added a brand new event, Phenomenology 2020. It's in March, late March. Just go to darknessevents.com. They have a special on tickets that lasts until, I believe it's tomorrow. I know it's May 1st. I'm getting my dates mixed up here, but up until May 1st, you buy a ticket, you can qualify to win a ticket. So you can bring a friend with you. Again, it's either phenom2020.com or darknessevents.com. Buy your ticket right now and get it early for Phenomenology 2020, and you can be eligible to win a ticket. So there you go. Get in for that right now. Lots of great guests already and guest speakers out there for Phenomenology, including myself and Dave. Go see the lineup right now. Go to darknessevents.com, click on the banner, go see Phenomenology, which takes place, I'm even stumbling a little bit, takes place out in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. It's going to be a great time out there in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. Let's get our show started, shall we? I don't want to keep our guest waiting because it is a very, very great guest. You know, one of the things that will stop me in my tracks, no matter where I am, I can be in the house anywhere doing something that can be extremely important, and I will drop whatever I'm doing if I see The Godfather on television, either Godfather 1 or Godfather 2. Godfather 3, maybe not so much, but Godfather 1 or Godfather 2, whatever I'm doing, I stop what I'm doing in my tracks like an infant listening to Baby Shark. I will stop what I'm doing and look at the television, and I'm mesmerized. I don't know what it is, but those two movies, Casino, if Casino is on, I drop what I'm doing. And there's something about, it's not so much mob culture, but it's those movies and even The Sopranos as well, but it's something about the way that those movies are done and something even about the culture itself that intrigues me and intrigues me very much. Our guest today is Gianni Russo, who has a brand new book out there, Hollywood Godfather, My Life in Movies and the Mob. And I tell you, folks, I picked up this book and I couldn't put it down. It was amazing. Gianni Russo has appeared in more than 30 movies, and I know you've seen him. You see his face, and automatically you know who he is. He's been involved in the production of several others and appeared in numerous TV shows. His most well-known roles, of course, are parts in The Godfather Parts 1 and 2, Good Night, My Love, Lepke, Laser Blast, Chances Are, The Freshman, Side Out, Another You, Super Mario Brothers, Any Given Sunday, The Family Man, Seabiscuit, Rush Hour 2. His lifelong association with organized crime has made him a witness to mob history, and we'll talk about that as well today on today's show. He's also a singer whose shows are sold out across the country. We'll talk about some of his well-known associations in music as well today. And in case you don't know who he was in The Godfather, he was Carlo Rizzi. He was the husband of Connie Corleone, who set up Sonny by the Causeway. And let's introduce to the show, ladies and gentlemen, Gianni Russo. Hi, Gianni.
How you doing, my man? How's everything? Good?
Oh, my gosh. More than good. I got goosebumps when I introduced you. I'll tell you that much. I feel like I've known you since I was just a wee toddler. I'm honored to have you on the show.
Great. Well, The Godfather was 48 years ago, so it's amazing how many people I've met because of that movie.
Well, I'm 49, so that tells you.
That tells there you. You go.
Well, yeah, that tells you how long I've been watching the movie. You know, I want to start out. Actually, we'll start at that point. Let's start with childhood. You know, it seems like as I went through the book and as I started reading the book, there's an interesting point to your book in this. It really is an interesting case of nature versus nurture. You're really a guy who's overcome a lot of obstacles, and I'll put it this way: you're a guy who's really had some interesting angels appear in your life, both in the physical sense in this world, and maybe angels sitting on your shoulder, haven't you?
Oh my God! Thank God. I mean, I've been so blessed with, like you're saying, both people who've mentored me and spiritually, because I'm 76 now and been shot, run over, stabbed, thrown out windows, put into situations with drug lords throughout the world and world leaders, and survived, obviously. And most of them didn't. In fact, most of them, all of them didn't.
Yeah, you know, I read it, you know, I hear people say this phrase, and sometimes I smile and I kind of giggle a little bit when I hear people say, I did it all on my own. You know, I got through this life, I pulled myself up by my bootstraps, I did it on my own. And I always think to myself, well, nobody ever does it by themselves, you know. We always have somebody who sees something in us and brings us along the way. And as I go through Hollywood Godfather, the book, I see that it's funny who at different times in your life saw something in you and kind of glommed onto you. And it's funny where you find the best people. You know, and
oh my God, yeah.
Yeah, and people that you would think, I'm trying to think of a nice way to put this, Mr. Russo. It's funny where you find really good people in the worst situations, you know?
Yeah, and, you know, like you're saying, I mean, my situation has varied so much from, you know, major crime figures to drug lords to presidents of the United States, and it's the luck I have, and if, you know, somebody's guiding me, as you pointed out, and I believe in that, and I'm here only because people did believe in me, and I've survived situations most people would have gave up on, because from my early beginnings in, you know, Bellevue Hospital, I was there for 5 years quarantined with polio, and here I am now 76 years later. I have no residual from it, and I have friends who are normal, and they're having hip replacements and everything else done. So I've been blessed in a way that I had all my downfalls physically at a young age from 7 to 12 and never looked back since then, which is a blessing in itself. And then to move on as I did, you know, with, like the mentors like Costello and Meyer Lansky and so many, many people. I'm truly blessed.
I want to ask you about that real quick, Mr. Russo, about the polio, because in the book, and again, we won't spoil too much from the book, but in the book, you do mention the bout with polio and the moment that you discover you have polio is absolutely frightening. It's a frightening moment in that, you know, at the time, you do mention that you're close with your mother and your sisters.
Right.
Not so much with your father. You mentioned that your father was very, very distant to you.
Well, he was a very old Gabon, a typical transplant Italian. And he wasn't. He was born here, but he took on that image. And he, I don't know. I mean, I love him till he died. And same with my mother, but after what happened to me, and it wasn't their fault, but how do you tell a 7-year-old why your parents are not visiting you and why they didn't even come for my birthday? So I left a deep-seated dislike, I would say, to say kindly, and a lot of confusion early on when, you know, someone at 7 or 8 years of age shouldn't be witnessing that kind of confusion And the reason I brought it into the book is because I think it really sets the tone of my drive to survive. And I want people to realize, and as you, when you get to the end of the book, I know you didn't get there yet, the last sentence of the book is, yes, you can. Because I want to encourage anybody out there, I don't care what the color your skin is, what your background is financially, or your parents, or whatever, but it's a situation. You have a dream. Life is too short, man. Go for it. And I'm a guy that could preach it, because I've had so many dreams, and I've conquered them all, which is unheard of, really. But and that's what it's about. I wanted to feel the pain as a young person. Don't take things for granted. I'm blessed. I have 9 sons, 2 daughters, and 9 grandsons so far.
Wow.
I've watched 20 kids.
Wow.
My oldest is 56. My youngest is 9 months old, my grandson. And you watch these kids develop and watch them waste their talents and time because they think they're living in a privileged world.
Uh-huh.
And what do I get next? It's not what you get. It's what you go out and earn.
Right. You know? Right. Yeah. Oh, and you have to, it seems like the lesson isn't taught in life that you have to fight for everything. And the fight never stops. That's the one thing too, that I think that we don't get taught from Jump Street. You know, I mean, you're not taught that, you know what, you should never be satisfied with what it is you got right now, because there's still more to fight for. You know, you fight from cradle to grave.
And I'm a true believer in that, because right now I'm pursuing 2 different careers at my age, and it's still the same challenges. I mean, it gets easier when you're financially backed as I am, but you know, but still, those doors just don't open for you. You have to be pursuant to them, and you got to be and have a resilience that you don't get depressed or denied. So, and that's you know, a lesson that I learned just being in the hospital early on.
Now,
and that's why I think the support of your family is wonderful, but it's about you.
Right. Absolutely. And that's one of the interesting things about facing polio at such an early age. You didn't have that familial support. You were put, as you stated, you were put in Bellevue at 7, and that was it. The family disappeared. Your mother didn't come to see you in that 5 years that you were in Bellevue. And
well, I want your audience to understand, first of all, Bellevue is a state hospital. That's a mental institution.
Right.
The good news, the original building is still there, because we definitely will be doing a movie about this. I've had so many, great interest from major studios already, because the book is a bestseller. Came out March 12th. And now we're in 3 other countries, Australia, and I mean, England, Italy, and that came out April 1st. It's a bestseller over there already. And I think people are starting to understand the read is not just about a guy and his achievements. It's a guy who had tremendous struggles and achieved, and with colorful people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the people that you'll meet through my story are icons throughout the world. I mean,
oh, yeah.
You know, presidents and Marilyn Monroe and Sinatra and Brando. I mean, I've been blessed, man. I never forget it. I never forget it.
Absolutely. So one of the things I'm interested in here with when it came to Bellevue, and you know, we have a movement right now in this country that kind of is a little, on one hand, it's a little scary. On another hand, it's been a kind of a strong movement in the last decade. That's the anti-vaxxer movement. And in your book, you talk about the very beginnings of the polio vaccine and how they were testing it at Bellevue, and how you were fortunate enough to have missed the very first testing of the polio vaccine, because the kids who got the polio vaccine were dying off in numbers, and they missed you. You were across the hall from the fortunate or the upper crust kids that were getting the polio vaccine? if I understand.
No, they chose, obviously, the people in the private room got it right away.
Yeah.
And then they split. Our ward was 20 beds. 10 kids did, 10 kids didn't. And again, I don't know, you know, I believe in God. I don't care what your belief is. And if it could be a monkey, but believe in something.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I was blessed. And at first, I thought it was denied and was very upset that I couldn't get it, only to find out it accelerated the virus.
Mm.
And thus I would have perished along with those kids.
So
life's lessons sometimes, you know, when you're disappointed, it may be for good reason.
So I can just see, as I was reading the passage, I could just see somebody quoting your book and saying, see, vaccines don't work.
Yeah. Well, and that's the wrong message, unfortunately, too. And I'm seeing it more here in New York because it's so prominent in the news because of the whole Sephardic group in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And they have 300-something cases, and I don't understand it. When me, just because of my background, me more so than ever, and I have all these children who are all vaccinated. I believe in it, obviously.
Oh, yeah, absolutely,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, it's terrible that these kids, some of these kids are going to die because of religious beliefs. And, you know, they have to really make a wise choice and make it not just be yours. I mean, think about their life and going on in life being diseased, unfortunately.
Right. And it doesn't, and that's just my personal opinion. I don't see the logic behind it, especially when we've cured such important diseases, or at least put them in such important remission, that now they're coming out in this day and age because people have chosen to turn their back on things that we've already put in remission. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But the story gets even more interesting in Bellevue as you progress in Bellevue. I want to talk a little bit more about Bellevue, because Bellevue is really the beginnings of not only the angel on your shoulder, or the angel that comes to help you progress in your physical condition, but also the first time you really run into evil.
I mean, Bellevue taught me a life lesson within 5 years to realize, be ready to be confronted with anything, any obstacle, any danger. And it when you start to look at that and digest it, that is basically my whole format of survival. It happened then, and I learned early on.
Tell me, first of all, about the angel that was there at Bellevue for you.
Oh, Dolores Barone. She was amazing. It's ironic because when I got there, she was just a candy striper.
Mm-hmm.
And I was there so long, she became an RN by the time I left. And fortunately, the last few years, she was actually the head of the ward, so she was able to give me the attention I wanted and I needed to survive and get out of there. And I don't know how we put that in medical terms. You read about it, but
yep.
I think we should leave that secret for everyone
yes.
to go reading.
Yeah, well,
there's no way to translate it in a gentle way, and not in a perverted way. But she inspired me.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say we're not necessarily a PG show, so you could you could say what you want to say. But yeah, she absolutely did things to bring you along. And again, we'll leave those details for the book. But she did. I think she went over and beyond. And again, someone who I think saw something in you that because you did work quite hard while you were in Bellevue to bring yourself along. It wasn't, much.
Oh yeah, she saw me working. You know, I was in a crib, and they kept this crib just because the whole left side of my body, I had no feeling, so I could just definitely roll over and fall out of the bed. But with that, I used the crib, and then I was using bicycle tubes, which today is basically a form of dynamic tension,
mm-hmm.
where I would just hold out bicycle tubes for as long as I can. They would tie it onto my crib railing, and then I would just either stretch out my leg on my left side as far as I could, and just, I would say maybe the rosary five times, just anything to keep my mind off of doing that. But what I was doing, I was building my elasticity muscles because they were all deformed from no mobility and just the virus itself. So I did that with my arms, the same way, by stretching out this. And she saw how diligent I was, where a lot of the kids just rolled over and went to sleep. They gave up. They really gave up. And it was terrible. Even with the mentoring and, you know, the chaplain of the hospital coming by and trying to talk to these kids, they had no will. And that's one thing about me. I have a will and a desire that is relentless. So again, why I have it, I don't know, but I do. So it's somebody up there likes me.
And that comes up quite often in the book, that this will and this desire to not just survive, but thrive. That's pretty amazing. Now, you do run into a threat, and we'll vaguely mention this threat. And you're warned by Dolores about this threat. And she kind of takes you aside and warns you about this threat, and you prepare yourself for this threat. Now, I have to ask you this, Gianni. Where does the wherewithal come? Because in the way that you prepare yourself, and I won't tell people how you prepare yourself, but where does the... I'll just say that you prepare yourself with a weapon. It's the first time that you prepare yourself with a weapon. But where does the wherewithal come to make a weapon?
Well, you know, it was an obstacle that got in my way when I once we could drag ourselves, they called it dragging. Mm-hmm. Where you can get yourself out of bed and drag yourself, and literally drag yourself along the floor. Then there were railings along the walls to get to anywhere we had to. And basically, they stopped giving you bedpans to relieve yourself because they wanted you to get out of bed. And with that, you know, I was building up my muscles. And one day, I'm dragging myself to the restroom, and there was a porter's broom in my way. And probably most kids with my good right leg would have kicked it out of the way. And I stopped and I looked at it, and I put it under my right arm, which had the strength to hold it against my body. And I continued to the bathroom. And I'm looking at this broom I was in no hurry to go back to bed. So me to go to the bathroom and stay 15, 20 minutes, it didn't mean anything because, first of all, I couldn't use a urinal because I couldn't stand up, so I always sat down. And I figured it was an omen. So when I got up, I went to the sink to wash my hand, and I broke the straw part of the broom off, all the bristles, and threw it in the trash and just kept the broom handle. Now, it was a porter's broom. It wasn't a full broom.
Okay.
It was one of those brooms you see the ushers or people clean, and a little porter's broom. And then I would just sit there every time I went to the same. I went to the same toilet stall every day because the radiators that provided the heat were hung on the walls.
Mm.
And this was just a long stick, maybe 3 feet long. And I just put it underneath there again, and it would hide with the conduit of the pipe.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I sat down every day, I would just use the top end of it where it was broke, and I would grind it in the grout of the floor tile. And I sharpened it to become a spear, knowing and being warned by Dolores that this gentleman may be coming. And it's not like we are today. The kids today are exposed to all kinds of things so early on,
right,
with pedophiles and this and that. But, you know, we didn't have the experiences that we all these kids are just over-intelligent because of the knowledge that's just transmitted on television and iPads and everything else. We just, ours was trial and error and just learned from the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And sure enough, the guy came and... I justify most of the violent things in the book in my own way because I am a practicing Catholic, but this may sound very strange to your listening audience, but I feel that I have a mission on this earth to get rid of some of the bad people. And that's maybe how I justify it. I mean, it's been, I've had a couple of situations where people have acted very violent to other people first, and I would step in and, took it out and made sure that those people weren't going to hurt anybody anymore. But, it's, again, why? I don't know. But, I mean, it just, I have that sense. I can walk into a place and say, I don't want to stay here. I don't feel right. Mm-hmm. And then tomorrow I'll see it in the news, it burnt down or something. It's like so crazy. I've had that inner sense that I don't know what it is, but thank God I have it.
Well, again, you can either chalk that up to a sixth sense that that may be ingrained in you, or it could be that angel on that on your shoulder, or it could be somebody up there looking after you. And, it could be you could chalk it up to the great uncle that, was mafioso in the old country. You never know.
I know. There's a combination. See, and that's the other thing. When you get to the end of the book, and if you had a list of writing the people who supported me from every walk of life, it's insane. Mm-hmm. Even the three popes. And now it's so ironic, and I could say this to you, and it's probably like a news bulletin. I was just invited to the White House.
Oh, wow.
Because Pope Francis is coming in, and he wants to address Trump about the border and all these, transplants and all these immigrants that are being turned away. And they feel that, because of my reputation with the Vatican for so many, many years, and Pope John, and I were really close through his whole reign.
Yep.
And, and now he's a saint. In fact, my little grandchildren tease me. They said, "Poppy, you're the only guy we know who really knew a saint," because I did. It's so crazy. Even for myself, sometimes, I think about it because my relationship with him. And if you go on my website, the audience goes, you'll see numerous pictures of me and John Paul. And they're bringing me there, which I love Donald Trump. I mean, I don't know. I'm not political in either way. But I got to know Donald early on, and in fact, he had me open Trump Marina in the 90s down Atlantic City for him, and gave me my first headliner role. I was an opening act prior to that to Don Rickles, thanks to Mr. Sinatra. But that's how crazy my life is. So I'm gonna go to the White House to meet my fourth pope. Which, again, why are they doing this? I don't know why. It's so funny.
Well, let me ask you this.
I think when Donald sees me, he's going to laugh because, I've seen him so many times in the neighborhood. He lives right up the block when he's here. But
let me ask you this.
But that's how crazy my life is.
What is that feeling when the kids bring up, you were friends with a saint? What does that feel like? I mean, I'm Catholic myself, so to say that you're intimate friends with a saint, to me, I have no grasp. I can't wrap my head around that.
I got to tell you a classic story about 4 or 5 years ago, because we control about 900 hectares of land all through Italy from Puglia down to Grosseto, and my two older sons have taken on. They left. One was here with Bear Stearns, and another one with Goldman Sachs. And they just took their package in the 80s. My oldest son is 56. So he wanted to go live over there. I said, go ahead and go. And he's on the farm there. My two little grandchildren go to a Catholic school in Puglia. So about 4 or 5 years ago, there was an earthquake. And on Sunday, my grandsons normally call me. And he said, "Poppy, we're raising money for the school. We had damage." I said, "I know." He says, and he gave me the number they wanted. And I said, "Well, listen, why don't you do this? Why don't you, tomorrow when you go to school, tell the Monsignor that you're going to donate all the money?" He said, "How am I going to do that?" I said, "Don't worry, Daddy, I'll arrange it with your father, and it'll be done." So about an hour later, my son calls me up. He says, "Why are you telling my son that?" I said, "Because that's what I want to do." And he said, "Are you sure?" I said, "Yeah, that's what I want to do." I said, "But there's one condition." He said, "Oh, I knew it. There's got to be a condition." I said, "Yeah, there is a condition. But I'm not going to tell you. Have the Monsignor call me." And he did. So this is how crazy my reputation is. So the Monsignor calls me a few days later. And he said, "Mr. Russo, thank you for your generosity, but we are not changing the name of the school." I said, why? He said, we're not naming the school Gianni Russo. I said, I don't want you to name it Gianni Russo. He says, what do you want to name it? I said, I want it to be the first St. John Paul Catholic school. Uh-huh. And with this, it caught him totally off guard. So what makes it even hilarious, months later, they're having a opening of the new school and a tour. And my little boy, the oldest one, Calogero, he's being led around by the nun, and they get to the Monsignor's office, and over his desk, just showing you how things turn around in life, there's a picture of the Pope and myself, which has become commonly known as all over the world, this picture. Mm-hmm. And my little grandson says, oh, look, that's my poppy. And the nun said, that's everybody's poppy. He's no, the guy next to him. Which I love telling that story.
Oh, my gosh.
It's so crazy. It's so crazy in my
that,
life.
That is funny. My great-grandmother had a picture of Pope John Paul in her house and got to get to Rome and got one meeting with him and was, God bless her, before she died, and she absolutely adored him. I almost tear up thinking about it, but it changed her life. So it was,
well, he had such an aura about him.
Yeah.
You know, and I've met a lot of people in my life, but even as the first two popes that I met, him being the third one, I mean, there was something about him. There was such a peacefulness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, early on, because of all I have 10 mothers to my children, and they were trying to, at the time when I first met with him in the 80s, they were trying to reconstruct the church and try to get people back, coming back. This is even before all this unfortunate pedophile stuff came out.
Mm-hmm.
But people were leaving the church. So he wanted to talk to me of how I can make it more comfortable for people like myself. Because maybe you don't remember this, but if you got divorced or anything like that, you couldn't go on the altar again.
Oh, yes.
So yeah. A lot of people weren't going to receive communion. And I don't know if you all are aware of it, who's listening to this. That's why now communion is not done on the altar. You walk up to the altar. The priest stands on the altar, but he hands you the communion off the altar.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't have to change the law. And I want to think that I'm part of that, because I suggested that. Because that in itself, because when people get up for communion and you don't, they look at you like you're some kind of sinner.
Yeah.
Sitting there. How come you're not getting up?
Yeah.
And it's those little things. But he picked up on it all and made the changes, which... You know, it makes it, I mean, I'm a guy that's never missed Mass. I mean, I haven't missed Mass, and now it's like, Jesus, 70 years.
Wow.
Because I was an altar boy prior to getting polio. And then we always had the chaplain come by in the Bellevue.
Mm-hmm.
And I became their favorite because, you know, I knew so much about religion and believed in it. And, you know, we had all walks of life in that ward. But they, after being there so long, they knew of me, and you know. But to me, religion is a total part of my life. And as I say, to whatever your belief is, and I've been, you know, I have two sons. I'm raising Jewish. As long as they're believing in something other than yourself, I think you need that. I need it's like, you know, we've been raised in a falsity most of our lives, especially our early lives. And I said this to one of my sons one time. I said, don't tell your son that there's a tooth fairy or an Easter bunny or Santa Claus. He said, what are you talking about? I said, do you realize we raise our children with all these fallacies? Now, what are they thinking when they're 12 and 13? And they said, why did you tell me there's a tooth fairy? There's no tooth fairy. Why did you tell me there's an Easter bunny? There's no Easter bunny. And I'm so obsessed now of trying to set my children straight so early on, not to confuse them. That's total confusion. So if you're not of a strong mind, that in itself, they could start getting doubtful of what you tell them early on because you've been lying to them.
That is true. That is true.
Most people don't think about it that way.
That's true. That's true. Well, what would you suggest that that you tell your kids then when it comes time?
Well, I mean, to me, but I'm religious. Well, whatever your religion is, mm-hmm. say, you know, put the tooth under your pillow and say a prayer, and maybe you get rewarded. I didn't tell you anything.
That's true. Well, that's not a bad alternative, to be honest with you. Yeah.
You know, because I had little kids waiting. I said, why aren't you asleep yet? I want to see the tooth fairy. They really think there's a tooth fairy going to come. You know, so, I mean, I think people should be gifted and rewarded for things they do. Even if it's just a prayer or taking out the garbage or doing something where you're building life's lessons. This is how you get rewarded, by doing a chore, by self-sacrificing some of your time, if it's just time. But I think that's a better lesson than believing in some guy with a red suit and a white beard.
Does that then, and I'm going to bring it around kind of full circle, does that then come from the upbringing of, you know what, I got put in certain situations where I couldn't count on a man in a red suit coming to save me, or I couldn't count on something magical coming to save me?
Well, that's exactly where it came from, because, you know, all the beliefs I had at 7 or 8 years of age were totally destroyed. And in a way, again, I look at what happened to me as a tremendous reward. I mean, I got to jump on life and a benefit that most kids don't have. They grow up in a fantasy, playing cowboys and Indians and doing all these things and going to school. And most people, even if they go to college, if they're lucky enough, during my time, most kids didn't go to college. They went if they finished high school. Because, you know, we were raised, go to get a job, or we need the money, go to part-time school or do something. But everybody had to pitch in. But my lesson in life was early on, and it gave me such a drive to earn. And that's why even when I had the polio and I still had some, you know, leftover deformity in my left side of my body, I've always been the guy that, you know, makes lemonade out of lemons. And I was lucky enough to meet Leo Rabinowitz, who had a secretary stationery store and secretarial supplies. And ballpoint pens just came out. Now, why was I on Delancey Street that day? I was looking for something to sell, and a light bulb went off. Ballpoint pens, they were new. So then I got the ballpoint pens, and I put them in a cigar box, and I started peddling all through Wall Street. But what I did also, which is a plan, you have to have a plan. Sit down and think it out. I went to the Marine Midland Bank and all the different banks because at that time people were getting paid with an envelope full of cash. They weren't doing checks. So the banks had to stagger the paydays even to the companies. Some companies got paid on Tuesday. Some company got paid on Tuesday afternoon because there was no way for the employees and the bankers to stuff all these envelopes. And I would show up just after he got paid because, you know, everybody feels good when they get an envelope full of money.
Oh, sure.
And I'd wind up with the change at least. And I was buying these pens for 15 cents. And some people give me 50 cents, 75 cents. Executives would give me a dollar. And then when I exhausted that route, I'd show up. They wouldn't even talk to me. They'd just open the drawer and show me all the pens they still had. That's when I went uptown.
Now, tell people how old you were when you came up with that idea.
I was 12, 13.
And think about where most 12 and 13-year-olds are when they, you know, they're not thinking about doing something like that.
Well, I want to say, I mean, I see it, unfortunately, even in my own family. Most of these kids today are laying in their bedroom on their iPads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they don't even go out and play anymore.
They're not. Yeah, they don't go out and play anymore. They're on their electronics.
Uh, it, yeah,
But before that, you'd come out of Bellevue and you essentially remembered a bakery and a baker that, and you went to him for a job before you'd come up with the idea for the Pens.
And, well, I had nowhere to sleep because I wasn't going back home.
Right.
I was determined. And old man Magnotti was a friend of our families for many, many years. And most people knew what that was happening in our neighborhood, even to me. So when I asked him for the job, he said, of course, come here. And I was trying to save my days to be on the street. And I just knew there was more for me to do. Where could I work at night and sleep at night? A bakery. It's the best. And yet, when he was so proud he had this new mixer, and I wouldn't use it. So I'd be mixing 50-pound bags of flour with the lard and the water by hand. And again, not because I thought about it. Subconsciously, I was drawn to it. But I was building my body, because if you have a mixed dough, you think about all the muscles you're using. And mixing it by hand, it's pushing and pulling. And I built my body up. In fact, I was building my body so fast, I wanted to stop it and start using the mixer because I didn't want my deformity to go away, because my business on the street was based on that. People felt sorry for me.
Yeah.
with my gimp arm.
And so you're building yourself up, and at the same time, you're trying to make a dollar out of 15 cents, so to speak. That's what the kids say these days anyways.
Right,
and then you've got your, as the kids also say, you had your side hustle with the Pens, and you're starting to make some money. Now, as you're making the money, with the Pens, you come across another angel, which at the time didn't feel like an angel, because he was trying to use you for some luck as well. And who is that that angel?
Oh, my God, Frank Costello, my mentor. No, it's funny because, again, after I exhausted downtown, I just got on the N train or the R train, which, I love about living in New York. Nothing changes. That train is still there.
Yeah,
so I came up from Canal Street and got off on 59th Street because I asked, And they said, get off on 50. I asked the conductor, I said, what's the best part of town uptown? I never was up here. It was funny because I used to look out my bedroom window in the hospital, and I saw the Empire State Building, because the hospital is located, for people who are not familiar with New York, on 30th Street. And that's First Avenue and 30th Street. And I could look out my window and see the tower of the Empire State Building. And I was a dreamer. And I said, someday I'm going to be uptown. I'm going to be at that building. Well, I only not went to that building. I went beyond. I went to 59th Street and Fifth Avenue. And when I came out of the train station, I can remember like yesterday, I get out of the train station, I look behind me, and there's 300 acres of green grass and trees called Central Park. And right across from that was the Sherry Netherlands Hotel on the corner of 59th Street. And then 60th, it was the Pierre. I said, this is where I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I had to ask the doorman at the Sherry Netherlands. I said, how many times do people go to church up here? He said, what are you talking about? I said, everybody's got their Sunday best on. Because I always saw people dressed like that on Sundays in my neighborhood. Everybody during the week would work in work clothes. But everybody was dressed to the nines. I had to tell him, I said, nobody dresses like this in my neighborhood. He said, where are you from? I said, Mulberry Street. He said, well, Mom, this is the way they dress up here. And I said, oh, this is my kind of life. I love it. And everybody was so generous to me. But there's one guy, like you're saying, it was a pattern. He had walked down 59th Street from the west side, stopped to get a shoe shine. That's when they had shoe shine boxes everywhere. But he liked going to the Sherry Netherlands barbershop, only to find out later it was one of his stops also for bookmaking. Not that he had anything to do with it, but that's, he frequented everybody that was supportive of his lifestyle. And then he'd come out, and he'd always, see me, and he'd touch my left side of my body, a pat on the shoulder or whatever. Or anytime he talked to me, he always held on to my left shoulder. And I didn't take any notice of it at all. And, he said, what are you selling there? I said, ballpoint pens. And I showed him. And he'd give me a dollar, sometimes $5. You know, in that time, a dollar is like a $50 bill in the 50s.
Right, yeah.
And never took a pen.
Hmm.
So one day coming out of church, I used to go down to a Precious Blood all the time in the neighborhood because I knew everybody there. And coming out of church right next to Ferrara's Coffee Shop, which is still there when you're talking about, you know, 60, 70 years ago, right next to Ferrara's is a religious store. In fact, I was just there this past Sunday again. And in the window, they had the logorns, the horns that people wear to ward off evil. Mm-hmm. They either have the horns mm-hmm. or the long horn. You see people wearing them all the time. Sometimes they're red, sometimes they're gold.
Mm-hmm.
And this one was unique because it had a hunchback on the top of it. I never saw it. So I went in to see old man Joe. I said, Joe, why is that hunchback on top of that? He said, that's an old Sicilian tradition. I said, what do you mean? He says, Sicilians are superstitious about cripples. They feel if you touch a cripple, it's good luck. And then a light bulb went off in my head because this is why this guy touched me. Always touched the left side of my body. So now I was really pissed off, to say the least.
I don't blame you.
Because I thought the guy liked me. It was another disappointment in my life, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
So now at the train station, they were selling these little rabbit's foots for 25 cents, I think they were. All different colors. So I got like a pink one or a chartreuse one. And I put it in my pocket, and I waited for him to come that day. And there he comes to touch me, I move my shoulder away. And he looks at me, and he goes to touch me again, I move away. He says, what are you doing? I said, I know what you're doing. He says, what am I doing? I said, I thought you liked me. I said, you're touching me because you think I'm some kind of a freak. You're touching me for luck? And he looked at me, he says, what are you talking about? So I got the rabbit's foot out. I said, next time you want luck, touch this. And he looked at Blackie, who I got to know very well through the years, and he said, you believe this kid? He said, you know who I am? I said, I don't know who you are, and I don't care who you are. You ain't touching me. I'm not a freak. So, I mean, the guy was so in awe with me. And then he said, what's your name? And I told him my name. And he said, who's Angelo Russo to you? I said, Angelo Russo, my uncle. He said, oh, yeah, when's the last time you saw him? I said, is this a trick question? He said, why? I said, my uncle was hung in 1947 in Sicily. He was like a boss over there. And he looked at Blackie. He says, this kid knows Angelo Russo. And I didn't know him. I knew him just stories. He was like a legend mm-hmm. to us, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So he said to me, you know where the Waldorf Astoria is? I said, of course. He says, be under the clock in the lobby tomorrow at 11 o'clock in the morning. Okay? I said, of course. He said, now, Blackie, take that cigar box. I said, you ain't taking my cigar box. He gives me $200 bills. He says, you don't do this anymore. He gave me $200. It's like, you know, it's like $5,000.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was at the Waldorf from that year on. I think it was like 56 to 1973. Whenever he wanted me, I was there until he died.
Wow.
And he made me a multimillionaire before I was 20.
Wow.
Now this guy was like, there was no, I don't know another person. I mean, I've met other individuals in my life that are wealthy, but this guy was so brilliant. I mean, later on I found out, you know, him and Joe Kennedy during Prohibition, they amassed millions and millions of dollars. And that's why he actually wanted, when Vito Genovese came out of prison, and they gave Frank his family to run. He didn't want it. Nobody realized. This guy did not want to be a street boss. And as soon as Frank came out, I mean, Vito came out, he was, welcome, arms, take it. And that's when, all the while, nobody knew it. Him and Maya Lansky and Tony Accardo and some major crime heads, that's when they created the syndicate. But, and that's why I like it because, again, talk about full circle. My life went full circle. Lines that are in The Godfather, I heard from the guys who said them. When they said, you know, we're going to be bigger than you with steel, they were already.
And when you go through your journeys in the book, it's amazing how many lines that are in there that are in The Godfather. I'm like, wow, that line and that line and that line. They were all lines that came from those
guys.
You know,
some young critic, I don't want to, he's a well-known critic. He said, there's a lot of dialogue that's in The Godfather. That's how he wrote this book. So I called the guy. I said, you know, I don't want to call you out on this. I said, but do you understand The Godfather was written by three mobsters by Mario Puzo? He said, no. I said, well, there was three. One was a guy called Joe Pafacci. He was the head of olive oil in the world. The other guy that had all the politicians and police in their pocket was Frank Costello. And the image that Don Corleone was my guy, Carlo Gambino. He was very, you know, with the cardigan sweater, with his tomatoes out in Brooklyn in his backyard. I said, so all those lines that I'm quoting these people, it's not dialogue from a book that came out in 1969. Yeah. And he was embarrassed. Well, I said, you know, that's what's the matter with critics. You're looking for the negative all the time and not the positive.
Right, right. In reading about, and it seemed to me, reading about the relationship between you and Frank, it seemed like, and don't take this the wrong way, Mr. Russo.
No, please.
It seemed like it was the father that you never had, but yet it also felt like it was also the distance was still there that was there with your father. In other words, he maintained his distance, much like there was the distance in the relationship with your father. So it felt like, at least in the book, it felt like he never got close to anyone, especially you.
Well, you know, he knew, and your observation is totally on. I mean, you nailed it. And that's what, to me, and that's why, as you get on to the book, when he sends me out of the country after the Kennedy assassination, mm-hmm. his distance was always that way. He didn't, they never get emotional because that's the world they joined. And, you know, they've been known to take up their own brothers if they have to, because mm-hmm. that's the oath of a morta. And to me, this is who this guy was. I mean, he was old school, yet he had respect for me, which my father never did. And that's what gave me, and then the proof of him sending me away, I was gone for 22 months. Most lay people don't know, they killed another 73 people. Anybody that was involved with this, and he knew. Now, obviously, I met with Carlos Marsalis. I met with Ocardo, Chicago. At the time, you know, most people don't realize Tony Batts, Tony Ocardo, he was always the boss of the family.
Well, let's...
Sam Giancana and all these front guys, they put them out there.
Let's back up a little bit about that story. Let's get into that story here real quick. I want to start with that story here just briefly, because... and this is one of the things in the book that, to me, my jaw dropped when I read this. Now, in this point in your relationship with Mr. Costello, with Frank, he's pretty much had you running all over the country delivering envelopes.
Yeah, and that mission started when they decided, or Joe Kennedy approached Frank Costello, mm-hmm. and they were in partners for years. And he wanted after he lost his son, Joe, he wanted his son, Jack, to become president of the United States.
Okay.
And Jack already had a reputation of being a ladies' man and all of that. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, him being Catholic, they knew it was almost an impossible thing. So, but he knew Costello could organize all the world leaders and all the United States leaders, and get the backing of the world leaders to endorse them. And they were going to do it through the brotherhoods of all the unions that they controlled. the international longshoremen, the Teamsters, culinary workers, steel workers. They controlled every labor union that had to do with construction. So with that said, even with all of that help, they had to get more help, and that would be Lyndon Baines Johnson, because they knew even during the primary, they didn't have enough votes. And to get Johnson, who hated the Kennedys and everything they represented, they got him by promising him. They told him after Jack's 8 years, they were very optimistic, you'll be the next 8 years. Because they've already had presidents in place. They've controlled six presidents throughout their reign in this country. And so that's why Lyndon Baines Johnson went along with it. So my first tour of America and mob families that I didn't know was bringing in the envelopes to spread around with all the union bosses and the supers and anybody that was connected to get the Brotherhood to vote for JFK.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the reward was that, you know, if you became president, they would invade Cuba and give them back their casinos. So it was a win-win. The mob would get their casinos back. Batista would be put back in place. And Maya and all of them would get all the investment they made back, because that was all taken away from them when Fidel Castro, you know, took over. And it was win for the government because they got rid of the mob and they went to Cuba and everybody was happy. The problem John did was make his brother Bobby attorney general. And Joe made that mistake. He convinced John to put his brother in place because Bobby was a righteous guy. And he felt he could legitimize John by, you know, being John's baby conscience, if he had to give it another word.
Okay.
So he wasn't so flamboyant. So with that, nobody realized the deep-seated hate. I mean hate that Bobby had for John's image in life and his father. He hated everything about Joe. He knew all about Joe's prohibition habits, and that's the last thing he wanted. I mean, his mother, that was Rose's son.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was it. And so he went after everybody. So now I find myself, again, doing the same tour, visiting the same people, but for different reasons. And I didn't know what the reasons were.
Right.
Thank God. Because, I mean, I got to know Senator John F. Kennedy in the wildest ways when, you know, Costello had the Sands Hotel in Vegas, and him and Joe actually were partners in the Tropicana Hotel. So I got to know this guy on a level that nobody had so much fun with. Even a guy at my age, you know, I'm hanging out with this guy. And every night we're at Jules Bodell, Jack and Trotter's property on the Sands property. That he was the front for them, and he had a swimming pool. And you can only imagine what was going on with that pool 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, I bet.
It was like the Ed Sullivan Show in the nude. I mean, everybody was, you know, it was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I just took this as, okay, something's going on, but I don't want to know. And that's how I got involved in that. Indirectly, I was just bringing messages and funding the assassination, basically, of John F. Kennedy, and then Robert right after that.
Now, I was going to say, there is one story in the book where there was a failed attempt at blackmailing both Jack and Bobby.
Oh, yeah, that was at Calneva.
At Calneva.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Calneva is a resort in Nevada that's on the borderline of California and Nevada. And it was it was used throughout, I don't know how many years, because of the way it was structured. There were all bungalows and private, and nobody had control of it, and just the mob, and you could enter it even from California. And what they were trying to do with what you're referencing is they did it to J. Edgar Hoover, and it worked. Chicago set up J. Edgar Hoover because they found out he was a cross-dresser, and they had this big party of all cross-dressing. And they had cameras everywhere. And they had J. Edgar Hoover with, you know, dressed as a woman and all of that. And for all the years up to the Kefauver Commission, J. Edgar Hoover himself would denounce that there's organized crime of the mafia in the United States because they were going to, you know, issue those pictures of him, and that would be the end of him. So it was Sam Giancana that came up with the idea, why don't we invite the presidents, the Kennedys, to come, because they used to frequent it anyway. But they had Marilyn, who they adored and loved, and I did too. Had the last 4 years of her life, I was a part, unfortunately. And we were all there, because after that whole Appalachian fiasco, Costello would go nowhere anymore. And I was basically his eyes and ears for these type of meetings. So that's why I was so well accepted. Nobody even thought any different that New York was coming and I represent him. And so I was privy to a lot of things. Not that I said anything. I was just there to bring back the message to him. And it's funny because, you know, the original name of the book was Don't Shoot the Messenger.
Oh, that's a good one.
And I thank God, though, that St. Martin's Press, Charles Spicer, my editor there, they came up with Hollywood Godfather, because now it's gotten bigger than ever. Even Paramount and people in the industry are talking about this as being the fourth Godfather. And I never even thought of that, because when you start chronologically, this is where it would keep going now, where we are now.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really helping me in the development of a motion picture of my life.
Right.
But with this, it's so... But back to the story. Here we are. I'm up in Caldera. Marilyn is there. And there's so many pictures of all of us at the pool. And it was a weekend. But John never shows up. Bobby shows. Joe shows. And Bobby has a conversation with Marilyn. And she's in her own cabin. But we could hear her screaming. This ain't happening. I'm not a part of this. And I'm going to the press. I'm going to screw you Kennedy boys once and for all. Because all but unbeknownst to all of us, Jack Kennedy promised Marilyn that once he became president, he was going to leave Jackie and marry her. That's how naive she was. And I don't know how he convinced her to be with Bobby, because Bobby fell in love with her for a minute, too. I mean, she's not hard to fall in love with. So with that said, she left that night. She called Joe DiMaggio in San Francisco to come and get her. He made the mistake and called Frank Sinatra and said, what's going on up there? He said, mind your own business and don't come. And I often wonder, what if Joe came and rescued this lady? Where would we all be today? I mean, there's so many different changes of the world that could have happened that way. But with that, she leaves. And soon after her, Bobby leaves. That's why my theory, and I believe it, and I know I've fact about it, Bobby Kennedy ordered her hit. He ordered it. And I know the guy who did it, because I was training with him for a while. And but he was a, you know, he was a contract killer for so many people, heads of state, anything, CIA. But he was a doctor, actually. But and that was the demise of Marilyn. And then they started seeing the pieces of the puzzle fall into place. And then they got to Joe and said, Joe, you got to do something here. We have nothing, or we're going to start killing off your family. And he approached his sons saying, you got to lay off the mob. And Bobby was adamant about it. He said, I ain't laying off nobody. All you crony friends and all that, they're going to jail. And I was, you know, it's funny, I was at Marcellus's house on that Sunday. I used to go a lot down there. I liked New Orleans, number one. And I got to know the guy, and the old man was great. And when they raided his house on a Sunday, like typical Italians, we have all the family over on a Sunday. It was outside in the yard, and the you know, the federal marshals came, and they handcuffed him, Marcellus, in front of his family and kids. And grandchildren. And he said to Bobby, right to his face, he said, you're dead. I'm going to kill you. So Bobby, with his little squeaky voice, said, oh, now you're threatening an attorney general, a sitting attorney general? He said, I'm not threatening you. I'm just going to kill you.
Wow.
No, I mean, these are things there's no way anybody's experienced these things. And I had the privilege just because, you know, I was around it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's part of American history.
You know, this begs the question, why not at that point, if you're Bobby and you're seeing, especially after the assassination of John, why don't you just stop?
I know. He couldn't. I thought it was brilliant what Chicago mob did with Sirhan Sirhan. They actually got him and hypnotized him. They knew key words of the speech that he was going to give at the Hollywood Roosevelt that would trigger this kid. They got Sirhan Sirhan a job as a waiter there long before. Once they booked the convention, they knew that's what the day they're going to do it. And this is long before metal detectors. They had guns planted all over that place. And they convinced Sirhan Sirhan, if Bobby got in, Palestine is going to be abolished because he's pro-Jewish, and you're gone. And this kid is, you know, a fanatic. Like a lot of these kids today we're seeing, like we just saw this weekend, these kids blowing up that synagogue. And
yeah,
they're all nuts. But, you know, they believe in ISIS. They believe in whatever they believe in. We live in a fanatical world, and it's gotten worse. But that's why, you know, it's so crazy when you hear these stories and how long this stuff has been going on.
Yeah. Oh, so now, we were on the point where Frank had sent you to Marcello's restaurant, Mosca's, right?
Right.
Okay, so he sent you with an envelope, and he said you were to get a message, and that was it.
Right. And I flew down. I had to go to the bathroom,
mm-hmm.
and Carlos said, there's somebody in there. So I waited at the bar, and this guy comes out, and he actually bumped into me. I paid no attention to him. But, you know, somebody bumps into you, look at him, and then I went to the bathroom, came out, and he says, you have something for me? And I gave him the envelope like I normally do, just slip it to him. It's an extra minute, slip it to him. And I said, what's the message? He says, it's on. Now, his chef got so, you know, I was so recognized to the chef, he made me a big thing of pasta vongole, knew I was coming. And they put this big plate down of clams and macaroni, which
mm-hmm.
I love.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, don't even look at it. You got to go. And I'm going, I'm getting back on the plane. I'm saying, it's on. I flew all the way down. So now I come back. I shower. I go down like I always do to the Waldorf. And there we are at 11 o'clock. And he says, what's the message? I said, it's on. He knew that kind of a message was either it's off or it's on. That was it. That's all he wanted to know. And I'm looking at him. And he reacted for a minute. And then next to him, he hands me a big manila envelope with all kinds of papers in it. And what was in it was Merchant Marine papers. And I'm saying to myself, what are these for? He says, I signed you on a ship as a hairdresser because of your background at Wilford as a Merchant Marine. I said, why? He said, well, just don't. Why? He said, also, there's $15,000 in there in cash. I told the guys that you were going to go to Layton's. We were buying clothes at Layton's at that time before we changed to Brioni. And he said, go to get a wardrobe. You're going to be sitting at the captain's table every night. He said, don't embarrass me. I said, okay. So now, this is like on a Tuesday, and the end of the week, I'm on a ship going under the Verrazano Bridge, and I'm wondering, what the hell am I doing on this ship? And they announced President Kennedy was shot in Texas. And I still didn't put two and two together. So now we're out at sea, and they just said he was shot. They didn't say he was dead.
Mm-hmm.
We're out at sea, and there's a telex newspaper that I grab right away, and the guy that I bunked into at Carlos's restaurant was that guy, Lee Harvey Oswald. And I'm saying to myself, and I went to my cabin, I mean, I was in shock that I had something to do with this, indirectly, but still, I mean, I got, as I said earlier, I got to know John F. Kennedy, a nice guy. I mean, a fun guy.
Right.
And now he's dead. And then I started to figure out what was going on. And part of the message was from Costello that morning. He says, when you get to Barcelona, the first port, you're going to get off the boat. There's going to be a guy with a sign for you. Just follow his instructions. It's okay. So I get off the boat, the first port, and there's this guy, Vito. And he says, come on, come with me. I said, well, I got to be back here, you know, when we disembark at 5 o'clock. He says, forget about getting on that ship. Are you kidding me? I said, I got about $10,000 worth of clothes on that ship. He says, clothes don't mean anything. And I stayed with this guy for 22 months.
Wow.
And the only reason Costello, again, like a father figure, he knew they had a hit list for everybody. And they killed 73 people. I don't care if you heard a whisper about it. They want to know, because this nobody realized this hit involved Lyndon Baines Johnson, now who is sitting president, the CIA, the Texas Rangers, whatever they were, that guard him, because he brought Kennedy to the target that day. He arranged for this whole thing. And the way the mob didn't trust anybody, New Orleans had Lee Harvey Oswald. Chicago had Johnny Rosselli. I can't tell you who New York had, because the guy's that's still the guy's family.
Okay.
But they all wanted their own hitters, plus the Secret Service. And the backup was basically, you know, the guards, that, I mean, the guy who's protecting the governor that was in the, what was his name that got shot? McKinley? What was his name? In the car with the president. He was in the front seat.
Yeah. Name escapes me. But yeah, I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
But they were all a part of this. And I couldn't believe it. And the CIA, they hated the Kennedys. I didn't know that until after.
So it was all just one big happy plan.
And that's when, you know, that even Chicago had Jack Ruby running all their Texas stuff. So they convinced Jack Ruby, we're going to get you in down to the galley when they're transporting Lee Harvey Oswald. We want you to kill him, and you're going to be a hero because you killed the guy that killed the President of the United States. I mean, they had everybody lined up. I mean, it was crazy how they all killed each other.
So was Oswald truly just a patsy, or was he the guy taking the fall?
No, he was a marksman. I don't know if you know anything about him.
He was later. Right, he
and
was a marksman.
Mark
yeah.
Dallas got to him was because he used to listen to late night radio all the time.
Okay.
And he heard this guy on some communist station, and he got mustered out. He was a Marine, got mustered out, and was trained by the Marines as a marksman, Lee Harvey Oswald.
Mm-hmm.
But they found so much paraphernalia of communist stuff and all that in his locker, they threw him out. And then Germany threw him out because they thought he was a fanatic. He moves to Texas, and Carlos summons him, comes there, and he says, you want to be a communist? He says, I got something for you to do. If you do this errand for me, and if you do this, Fidel Castro will open arms, and you can stay there and live as a communist and be one of his top guys. This guy bought the whole thing.
Wow. Huh.
It was crazy the conspiracy. I mean, and you know, it's funny because I did a movie you mentioned earlier. I did so many movies, but Any Given Sunday was with Oliver Stone, and Oliver Stone, long before that movie, used to pick my brain because he wanted to know. He heard that I knew something about the Kennedys, and I wasn't going to tell that maniac anything. what he did with that movie, JFK, it was such a disaster. It's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. Again, my jaw hit the floor when I was reading that entire chapter, especially the you running into Lee Harvey Oswald. When you read that, it's just like, oh my God.
Yeah, it's crazy.
You know, that moment where you touch history, you know, and there are moments like this in the book where you slam headlong into history, and it's like you're involved, but you don't want to be involved.
Yeah, and you know, it's so crazy that you should say that, because Pat Picciarelli, who co-wrote this book with me, is amazing how he got me down, my language, my meter in my voice, everything. Mm-hmm. And when I first told him that, he said, "That's impossible." I said, "Pat, I'm telling you what I saw. You can say anything you want. You want me to tell you my life story? I'm telling it to you."
Mm-hmm.
He said, "Well, he was in Texas and this and that and the other." I said, "Pat," and you know, people don't know Pat's background. He was a lieutenant in organized crime in New York when he retired. So he knew all about me for years. Never knew. Everybody figured, "What's this guy doing? What's he do? You know, we see him with everybody. No matter who, if they're watching, I don't care if they're watching O'Neill Della Croco, John Gotti, who they're watching, I show up somehow." But they never see me doing anything. You know, I'm not, at that time, I was far beyond that. I was an international courier, money, and licensed. But I ain't telling anybody that either. But so with this said, he got in touch with people that are still working, only to prove my theory was right, that Lee Harvey Oswald was there.
Wow.
But he wasn't privy to federal stuff, but he's, you know, through the years they all become friends. And he just wanted to verify it. And plus, most people don't realize St. Martin's Press is a division of Macmillan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When they got the galleys on this book, they had a battery of lawyers go through this because they can't get sued. See, most people don't realize their fact finders have to find if there's a loophole. And it could be easily taken out of the book. You know, but you know, the only one guy I was really worried about writing about it, because I waited a long time. I had to get permission from certain people, even out of Italy. And I waited many years for the book to come out, because mm-hmm. I was waiting for certain people to die. And there was only one guy that I was really worried about, because I write about him. I don't know if he got to that part yet. When I had the confrontation with James Caan at Jilly's restaurant with, you know, Junior Carmine Persico.
Mm-hmm.
And Persico was the only man living. He was doing 139 years. But Junior is a maniac, was a maniac. And, it was all kind of what side of the bed he got up at, that if he would come after me or not. And as luck would have it, again, an angel on my shoulder, my book came out March 12th. Junior died March 7th.
Oh.
Is that crazy?
That is crazy. That is crazy.
And that was the last element, but I couldn't wait any longer. I figured this guy, I know Junior. You know, he was in good health and all. I didn't know he got cancer.
No.
But he died then, and because, you know, his son, Allie Boy, all those guys are still around, but that was it. But now, here we are, you know. It's crazy.
There's no, I mean, Allie Boy doesn't have any malice towards you for putting anything about him in the book or anything like that? No. Okay. So let me ask you this, Gianni. Let's get a couple of stories about The Godfather and about how you got into getting into The Godfather, because I know you had read the book by Mario Puzo and you were...
Well, actually, I had somebody read it to me, because me reading a book, I'd still be reading it. No, I thought with my ego, and I had a pocket full of money, I'm 25 years of age, mm-hmm. and I always wanted to be an actor. I always liked that whole lifestyle, you know, being around the Cope. I used to see all these people in there all the time. And so I wrote a scene for Michael, Sonny, and Carlo. I shot it and submitted it to Paramount, only for them to let me know that they're really using name actors. There was a story that they were going to use unknowns, and I believed it. So they wrote me a letter back almost immediately saying, "We sorry we misled you. Obviously, you spent a lot of money, but we're really using actors." And then again, as my life would be, and it's been proven, the next thing you know, Joe Colombo starts picketing the FBI building in New York, and he used The Godfather as an example of how the Italian-Americans are being defamed with being mobsters and all of that, and he was going to picket it, and the movie's not going to be made. He wanted no neighborhoods or unions to cooperate. So I figured this is my opportunity because I've been around mob people all my life. Mm-hmm. It's always about money first. I mean, I know them and I love them, but show them how to make money. So that's what I did. So I go see Joe in Brooklyn at his club. I said, Joe, here's an opportunity here for you to make a lot of money. You should get, you know, have a meeting with these people. What you don't like, let them change it. If they change it and they cooperate with you, have everybody cooperate with them. He said, how do we make money? I said, we get this done. And I put myself in it right away. I said, we get this done. And he didn't stop me. I figured, okay, I'm in. And I said, we'll get the world premieres in every theater in the United States. The world premiere, you know what that's going to be? You'll get $100 a head a ticket. Meanwhile, you're selling $1 a button, these little lapel buttons. He was raising money to support his league by getting $1 for lapel buttons. Hmm. I said, we can make thousands of dollars with this, hundreds of thousands of dollars. So with that, he said, can you get it on? I said, I don't know. Give me permission. Let me go try. And he did. And that's how it all happened.
Wow. Well, there you go.
And that's how I became an actor.
There you go. And there's an interesting story, too, about Marlon Brando trying to have you thrown off the film, and you basically setting him straight, but he didn't really believe that, or he actually thought you were not auditioning, but he thought you were throwing him an act.
Well, you know what was funny is because I never acted before, and I got my first call sheet ever, and for the lay people who listen, not in our business. A call sheet basically is telling you exactly what time to show up, where to be, everything about it. And I got my first call sheet, and they told me to be up on 119th Street, Patsy's Pizzeria, which I used to frequent all the time. It was a 24-hour pizza place in Harlem that Fat Tony Salerno, who was the head of the Genovese family, had. And I used to go up there all the time for a lot of different reasons. So I was comfortable with that. At the bottom of the paper, it said, do not have eye contact or approach Marlon Brando at all. That was for everybody. Pacino, nobody could do it. So we went in, we had the first rehearsal. It was about a half hour in, and Brando walks over to me. So I figured, well, I ain't doing anything. Well, he came to me. So he says to me, you're a big actor. I said, no. You have a movie coming out. I said, no. You're sure a television actor? I said, no. He said, well, you're not on Broadway. He said, I know everybody on Broadway. He said, you're right again. He said, who'd you study with? I said, study what? And with that, he calls Coppola over. And I never broke down the script. I was there for the ego and being in the movie. What do I care about breaking down the script? And he gets Francis over, and he says, Francis, this guy is playing my son, my son-in-law. He says, yeah. And Francis had nothing to do with me getting the part, obviously. Paramount did. So he said, I know. He said, well, he's got to be a great actor. He said, my understanding is this kid's not even an actor. He said, he marries my daughter. He undermines my family to the Barzinis. He gets my oldest son, Sonny, killed. This guy's got to be believable. You should rethink this. Now, my balls are twisted. I'm saying this guy's trying to get me fired. So I don't know protocol, as I said, on a set or even a rehearsal. I said, Francis, go over there a minute, meaning Coppola. Now, I can't dismiss a director. No actor can. And then I did the next sacrilege. I put my arm around Brando. First, they said, don't even look at him. Now I'm touching the guy. And I want to walk him to the back of the room to get him out of earshot of everybody else. I didn't want to embarrass the guy. So I turned him around. I'm right face to face. And I said, let me just tell you something, Mr. Brando, out of all due respect to who you are, you fucked this up for me. You hear what I'm telling you? If I lose this job, I'm going to suck on your heart. You'll bleed out right here. He stepped back. He looked at me. He said, that was brilliant. He thought I was acting. And then he actually went out and told Francis, Francis, come here. This kid's good. Leave him. No, he's great, man. No. And that was it. And I was friends with him until he died. That's amazing. I got him his biggest paycheck, you know, for freshman.
Yeah?
I did a three-picture deal with Michael LaBelle and Andrew Bergman.
Mm-hmm.
We did Chances Are, Striptease, and The Freshman. And I convinced Brando to do it. They paid him $12 million.
Wow.
But it was crazy. And the guy was such a mentor to me. You know, I'm the only person in the world that could say Marlon Brando was my acting teacher, Frank Sinatra was my singing teacher, and Marilyn Monroe made me a man. How could you say that? Nobody can say that.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And I want to talk about Frank Sinatra real quick, because there are some amazing stories about Frank Sinatra. And both Dave and I are huge Frank Sinatra fans. We saw Frank Sr. here in town. Frank Jr. was conducting the orchestra. That was, Frank would go to the different cities of the different Super Bowls towards the end of his career. And 92, the Super Bowl was here in Minnesota, and he performed at Met Center. So we went to that concert. And then Dave and I had the funniest picture with Frank Jr. Can you take a...
Yeah, that poor kid. He died such a young age.
Yeah, probably. I know, and it was a tragedy. But can you take a really bad off-color joke?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we were... The station I was working for at the time, KLBB, we played a lot of big band, and we were the sponsor of this concert that Frank Jr. was playing over at the Minnesota Orchestra. And at the time, he was doing a tribute tour for the music of his father, Frank Sr. And so we were doing a meet and greet backstage, and we went to meet Frank Jr., which is a huge, to us, huge honor to meet Frank Jr. Dave's standing on one side. I'm standing on the other. We're taking a picture with Frank Jr. The look on Frank Jr.'s face looked like we were going to kidnap him all over again.
I know. I mean, unfortunately, well, his father abused him a lot. Well, I laughed because even with Dean's kids, they never saw their kids. If they saw them on Sunday for an hour or two, they were never home.
Mm.
Like even Dina Maughan, she talks about her relationship with her father. Bullshit. These guys were players, man.
Yeah. He,
especially when they were growing up. He was so enamored with Ava Gardner, he'd pay no attention to nobody.
Now, you said something interesting in the book about Ava Gardner. Or did I not read this right?
You read it right.
Did I read
they
it right?
They were all bisexual.
Really? Ava Gardner was bisexual, huh?
Of course.
Yeah.
You know how many of them were? That's how they got to where they were.
Hmm.
I mean, Tony Curtis, Rock Hudson, Marlon Brando, hello.
Yeah, well, the last two were, I think, probably more obvious than the others, but that's an interesting, that I was, when I read that, I went, very interesting. But Frank Jr. couldn't have been a nicer guy. I mean, he was.
Oh, yeah, he was like an altar boy.
Yeah.
He had no charisma. Nice. His father had everything. This guy, I could go on and on and on, but he's deadly Malone.
But it was, he just had this terrified look in the picture when we took the picture with him. But the stories about Frank Sr. in the book are absolutely, they're absolutely fascinating. I'd like to hear one of your favorites from, and not just from the book, but one of your favorite stories about Frank, why we have you on the line.
Well, I mean, he was a great practical joker. We've had so many great times together, but he's a lousy drunk. When he gets drunk, forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the funniest moments of my life with Frank, because my boat was moored right next to his, when Budweiser bought him that big boat, was outside of the Fontainebleau, and my boat was right next to the Eden Rock. So he'd always send somebody over. And we had a golf cart they used to drive around the beach with on. Rather than a car. So he says to me, kid, you want to come to an event with me tonight? If we're going to go up to the Diplomat up in Lauderdale, they're having a big rally for the Anti-Defamation League. I said, I'll go. And then after that, we got a black tie at the Fontainebleau for Moshe Dayan for Independence Day of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
I said, black tie, it's 80 degrees. I said, just come. Come when we'll have some fun. So, you know, when Sinatra says to go, why not go? I'm in a blast. So now I come off my boat, and I had a tuxedo on, like you said, and shoes, no shirt, and no socks, and a bow tie on my, just tied around my neck.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I told you black tie. I said, you told me tuxedo, black tie. I got the black tie and the tuxedo on. He said, oh, come on, let's get in the car. So what we did earlier in the day, he said, let's go over to Barlow's Jewelers. It was a high-end jewelry store. I think it's still there on Arthur Godfrey Drive. So we go over there, and he, you know, when he walks in anywhere, people go crazy. So they usher us to the back room, and he says, I want a pair of opera glasses. He said, I want the best you have. So they bring him up these beautiful gold-plated opera glasses. I'll take this pair here. He says, do me a favor. Cut them in half. And I'm saying, what the hell is he doing now? Yeah, he's cut them in half and wrapped them separately. So we go. So now we go up to the Italian Defamation League. We're a great event. They raised like $38,000. Everybody was yelling and screaming. It was crazy. Now we come down to the Fontainebleau, and I walk in there in the room with him. I knew, you know, I know everybody that, you know, Ben Novak, who owned the place. I had a room in there anytime I wanted for nothing. So we're on the dais. Now is Moshe Dayan on one side. That's when Sammy Davis, you know, was practicing Judaism because of Brett Atlin, his wife. And so now Frank walks up. He said, Johnny, give me those two boxes. I had one in each pocket, and I gave it to him. And he says, and he's standing at the podium, and he gives one to Moshe Dayan and one to Sammy Davis. They both have one eye. And he proceeds to say to Moshe Dayan, is, you know, that three-day war, if they came in on the right, it'd still be going on. Everybody started laughing. And then he said, you know, I was so proud of my people. Gianni and I just left a diplomat to defamation me, and we raised $38,000. I just heard you guys raised $3 million. You know what the difference was? Yours is in pledges. You're never going to collect it. Mm-hmm. Ours was in cash. And that's what I end this interview with, man. Thank you so much, man.
You're very welcome. Actually, can I get one more story for me? And this is why. I'll tell you why, Mr. Russo. We have a segment on the show that we normally do after the interviews, and it's called Dumb Crime, Stupid Criminals. And we're not going to do it today because this interview has been amazing, okay? But you have a story in the book, and I'm hoping you'll tell it here today. And it has to do with collections on a couple of Cuban guys. Do you know the story I'm talking about?
Oh, my God, with the water pistols.
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, yeah, no, that was so much. That was from my friend Jay Weiss.
Right.
Jay Weiss was one of the originators of Southern Wines and Spirits, which today is a $8 billion company. And he had package stores, and he asked me, he said, I got these guys down in Cuba, in the Cuban neighborhood down there. They owe me a lot of money. I said, how much money do they owe you? He said, you owe me about $25,000. I said, you crazy? That's a lot of money. He said, you collect, you can have half. I said, I can collect it. He's this tough neighborhood, I'm telling you. So my grandfather built a grotto on Staten Island, and I used to watch him wash down the stones with muriatic acid. And he taught me how to use it. So you can wash anything down with this acid, but you have to cut it, certain strength to cut it. I said, okay. So I go to a brickyard down in Florida, and I buy a gallon of muriatic acid. I buy a rubber pail, rubber gloves, and I go buy two water guns, ridiculous water guns, like turquoise or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I fill them up, and I put them in my trunk, and I balance the bucket. I mean, the acid was locked. The water guns were with the acid. And I will never forget, it was an Eldorado, and they had the front wheel drive, and I pulled up, I'm all dressed up in a suit, and I pull right to this liquor store, and there's these three or four guys sitting out there, and they're looking at, who's this guy? I get out of the car and say nothing to nobody. I open the trunk, and before I get the water guns, I say, who's the toughest guy here? And this guy standing like, you know, a step or two above me on the on the porch of the store. He said, "I am why." I said, "Well, you know, you owe my friend of mine some money. I'm here to collect it." He said, "Oh, really? Who's your friend?" I said, "Well, you know, Mr. Weiss. You owe him $25,000." He said, "You're going to collect it?" I said, "Yeah, I'm going to collect it today." And they all started laughing at me. I said, "Now, you're the toughest guy, right?" He said, "I am, man. I reach and I get a water gun and I spray his crotch." and his pants are starting to smolder. And he said, "What the hell are you doing?" I said, "I'll tell you right now. In about 5 minutes, if you don't wash that shit off, you ain't peeing no more." And now another guy gets up. I spray him. I said, "Get me this fucking money now." They went in and got the money. The guy was in there peeing his pants on himself, wetting it all. But I just put enough in to get, you know, to do what I did. And I got the money. I left. So I go see Jay. I said, "Here's your money." It was all there. He says, "I know, I told you to take care of it." I said, "Jay, no, no." So he gave me $6,000. I said, "Okay." And from that day on, I did more work for that guy. He couldn't believe how I got the money.
That story is amazing. That is great. Gianni Russo, the book is called Hollywood Godfather, My Life in the Movies and the Mob. It is an amazing book. Go get it, folks. We have a link in the description of this show. I'm telling you, I've got my copy. I enjoy it. I relish it. There are more. We just scratched the surface in just this program right here. There's more stories in the book that are even more amazing. I'm telling you, you'll be inspired. You'll laugh. You'll have a great time with this book. Mr. Russo, I greatly appreciate you joining us today.
Oh, no, thank you. Hey, and can I share my podcast? I have a podcast.
Yes, please do. Where can we find it?
Every Wednesday night, I post a new one. It's called Hollywood Godfather Podcast. If you like these stories, you're going to love all of these. We're up to 12 shows already.
All right. Hollywood Godfather Podcast. And where is it? Is it on Apple Podcasts?
It's on iTunes, okay. Everything. You can get it anywhere.
Great. All right. Be sure to look for that as well. The Hollywood Godfather Podcast. Look for the book, Hollywood Godfather, My Life in the Movies and the Mob. Again, you'll be able to find it in the description of the show. I'm going to check out the Hollywood Godfather Podcast because I've had an absolutely wonderful time, probably one of the best times I've ever had doing the show.
Well, I appreciate that. And I appreciate you having me. Tell Dave I missed him. Everything is good.
I will let him know that. Thank you very much, Mr. Russo. Again, it's been a pleasure.
All right, thank you. All right, God bless.
Thank you. God bless you as well. All right, folks, that'll do it for today's True Crime Tuesday. Dave will be back again next week. And thank you very much for joining us again for the best in true crime radio. This has been True Crime Tuesday.